KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The president had actually put more on the table during this last negotiation than the so-called fiscal conservatives leading the House.
Really? Because I don't know anything that he wanted to cut.
And I just told you.
We have no desire to be Starbucks at all. So, no, you know, we have a very good plan, and I think the right person will get this, I think, at the end of the day.
America deserves better than just another example of a government that has forgotten who they are there to serve and why. 66 days and counting. Shame on you. Shame on Congress.
Chris Christie shaming Congress. Patrick Dempsey getting excited about taking on Starbucks. And Adam Smith on Fox and Friends, arguing about the fiscal cliff. Those are some of the stories we'll be taking up this hour on Weekday as we review the news of the week with Knute Berger, editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine, writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com, author of Pugetopolis. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Steve.
David Horsey, political cartoonist and columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Good to see you again. Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger.
Nice to be here.
And Bruce Ramsey, editorial writer for the Seattle Times.
Thank you.
It's a big crowd today, and I would like you all to conduct yourselves accordingly. fiscal cliff. Who didn't fall off the political cliff? Skip.
Well, yeah, we kind of all went over.
Anybody win?
Well, it's a long way to the bottom. We've got another couple months before we hit.
This is like falling off a cliff with many bounces.
Exactly. Bouncing from ledge to ledge. People argue on both ends of the political spectrum about who won. The Republicans are insistent that the Democrats won. A lot of the liberal Democrats insist that the Republicans won. I don't know. I mean, that's kind of what compromise is.
Smells like?
It smells like, yeah. We don't usually see that in Washington, D.C. anymore. But, I think it was at least a modest victory for the White House in terms of getting taxes increased, getting unemployment extended, and getting more spending than cuts.
What do you think? Are we like Wile E. Coyote, David Horsey? You know, he bounced down the cliff?
It is a bit like Wile E. Coyote, but I think if you want a simple test for at least one measure of who won, check if Grover Norquist is smiling or not, and he is.
He was quite happy because he said Congress got to vote on tax cuts.
Yeah, well, exactly. There are a lot of ways to read this, and I don't think we'll really know who won for 2 months till this whole process is done. But you can read this as an Obama victory because he got tax increases on the more wealthy Americans and forced the Republicans to allow that to happen. But Grover Norquist was grinning even before the vote was taken, and he is the anti-tax Mandarin of America. And if he's happy about it, that tells me something. And of course, what he's happy about is that tax cuts that 10 years ago Democrats were saying were dangerous because they drive up the deficit and had to be temporary are now permanent for about 98% of Americans. So
yeah,
it's taken a huge amount of potential revenue off the table. And that's either good or bad, depending on how you look at it. But obviously for Grover, that's a really good thing. And he told the Republicans, you know, don't worry about the tax cut pledge because you got to pass on this one. This is a good deal.
What do you think about that, Eli? They made the Bush tax cuts permanent, and for the last 8 years, Democrats have been saying we can't make them permanent.
But we repealed them for people earning over $400,000 a year as individuals and $450,000 as couples, if I'm understanding it right. So there's there's that. I mean, I think that is the victory that the White House keeps on pointing to and that the left should pay attention to. That's a pretty high level. It's not, you know, it's not people earning $200,000, which I think is where the White House started, but it's something.
Do you think that tax cuts, Bruce Ramsey, are now not tax cuts, but revenues are off the table for the next two cliffs we'll be approaching? That's the argument that Republicans have been making.
I hope they are, but I don't know that they are. It all depends on the balance of power in Washington. But I think on this deal, Obama got something of what he wanted. He brought back the Bill Clinton the top tax rate of 39.6%, and he raised taxes on dividends and on capital gains for the people over $400,000 in individual filing. That was a victory.
So is it a wedge opening for if they have to, they can say, well, let's drop that rate to 39.5. Let's have it affect people making $350,000 in a year or so.
It might be. It depends on the balance of power. I think that they made a victory, and we'll see what comes next. That's the worry. Of course, the left is worried that what comes next is a lot of cuts, and we haven't had any. And there weren't really any cuts in this package.
What was done was the easiest possible thing for everybody. Republicans...
Tax cuts for all.
Right. I mean, tax cuts for almost all the middle class. The people who have had their taxes go up, you know, they don't like it, but they're certainly the people in the country who can most easily afford it. Both sides can claim some sort of victory, but it's easy to give stuff to people and take away from people who are super rich. It's a lot harder now in the next 2 months to come up with either additional revenue, which Democrats would like, or finally face the changes to entitlements and other, you know, and defense spending and whatever else needs to be done. That's the tough thing that was put off once again. And the one argument is that Obama should have, you know, he probably can claim a little victory here, but he might have had a bigger win if he'd come out with a comprehensive plan of tax increases as well as spending cuts and said, this is my plan, and sold it to the country and tried to make it happen. The problem is I'm not sure if he had quite enough leverage to do that. Probably it would have taken really going over the fiscal cliff and probably still be fighting about it right now, but it might have gotten things out of the way.
Did you want to say something? You looked like you were going to say something.
Well,
but standing over me as you are.
Looming over you as standing here. I have a lot to say. I mean, I think outside of the fiscal cliff, it was a devastating week for Republicans in terms of their PR.
You do think that?
Well, I think the Hurricane Sandy relief issue, where you have Republicans talking about Congress in the really almost unprecedented, at least in recent times, language they were using.
Members of Congress.
Yes, members of Congress, Representative King from New York, saying that, you know, anybody would be a fool to donate to the Republican Party, telling them not to come to New York to raise money, saying what they did was a disgrace. And, of course, nobody likes to get tongue lashed by Chris Christie, who's the best scolder in America. And of course, he was devastated. Now the Republicans will move. But in terms of image and where the priorities are, I think this sets them up for difficult times ahead in terms of things like, focusing on the basics and not politicizing everything. That was the argument that Chris Christie was making, was disaster relief never was used as a political bargaining chip. Now it is. That's a disgrace. And that's something the Republicans are doing. And he pointed his finger specifically at the House Republicans. I think as you look ahead at negotiations, it raises the stakes around the issue of the debt limit and whether they're going to go back to a Gingrichian strategy of trying to shut down the government. Now, even Gingrich thinks that's a bad idea. He doesn't think the debt limit should be used as a bargaining chip and that the Republican need a different strategy. But I think this week set up some additional leverage for Obama in terms of public opinion when they get to that point in a couple months.
My question is what then should the Republicans do if you really want to control spending, if you want to force a decision and get some of the Democrats to agree to some changes in entitlements, the defense, farm programs, something to get the spending down? What do you do? The debt ceiling is a gimmick, completely a gimmick, and so was the fiscal cliff. It was a gimmick, but what then? How do you make a decision instead of just sort of kick the can down the road forever and ever and
well,
ever?
Well, the debt ceiling, the outcome of the debt ceiling debate won't be a gimmick, though, right? That's the difference between what we had this last time and the political football about the debt ceiling will be a gimmick, but they do have to do something about the debt ceiling.
Yeah, there is a limit to how far they can kick it down the road. They're going to find that limit, but I think the Treasury is saying it'll run out of money at a certain point.
Can I just say that politics, by definition, is kicking the can down the road? Nothing ever is completely resolved, certainly not in a democracy. We don't have Hugo Chavez in the White House. You know, we if you look at political history, compromises are made. Things are never fully resolved. They're never fully implemented. They're never fully funded. They're never fully cut. These things are ongoing. And the question is, you know, can people come together and make incremental steps that get you in the right direction? Mm-hmm. Republicans have to convince enough Democrats to go along with them on cuts. That means the cuts are not going to be as draconian as the Republicans would do on their
own. Yes, precisely.
Exactly. So they have to find a strategy that doesn't alienate the very people they're trying to bring on board.
Well, I think the smart thing for the Republicans would do would be actually to follow Newt Gingrich's advice and not go to the brink with the debt ceiling. The fact is that that's sort of a false playing card, because most Republicans don't want to ruin the credit of the United States either. So that's like saying, I'm going to shoot myself if you don't do what I say. I'd say make a deal early on the debt ceiling. But they still have the driver of the whole
sequestration
word. Sequestration. you know, only half the debt or the fiscal cliff was dealt with, and that was the tax part. There's still all these big cuts sitting there waiting to happen, and that should be their leverage. Say, okay, we'll pull back. You know, nobody wants that to happen either. So that's where you battle it out. But probably part of that is to make an early deal for additional cuts by saying, okay, we'll get the debt limit out of the way, and then let's figure out, you know, what level of cuts, because these cuts are coming in no matter what unless something happens.
What's your opinion on sequestration, on 10% cuts across the board for the federal government?
Well, it's heavy-handed, it's ham-fisted, and maybe it's the only thing you can do. I hope it isn't. But I don't like the idea of just saying, well, we can't do this, and therefore we're going to just exempt ourselves from this thing, because there's reality behind it. Reality is you need to cut the budget something like that amount to get on some kind of track toward balance. I mean, we're so far from balance, and we've been so far from balance for several years now, we really need to do something.
I don't remember, and maybe you all do, didn't the state have a similar issue with across-the-board cuts?
Yes.
Was it a decade ago, or was it more recently?
More recently, in the last few years, in this recession.
But did they do across-the-board cuts, or did they, in the end, take a scalpel rather than the sledgehammer?
It was a mixture of mostly the scalpel.
Well, I mean, you constantly have that issue in the state because you can't raise taxes.
Right.
So every single legislative session.
Well, and you have a balanced budget.
You have to have a balanced budget,
right.
Yeah.
So every single legislative session.
Borrow money from China.
This issue. I like the sequestration and the kind of limit it imposes. It forces a focus in D.C. They've figured out a way to kick it down the road a little bit. But it's this great hammer that hangs over the heads of our congressmen and forces them, congressmen and women, and forces them to act. And, you know, Knut was saying, yes, politics is partly not getting the whole thing done, but, you know, it really focuses attention on what needs to get done, and then hopefully creates another incentive for politicians of both parties not to be seen as unable to do what the people who elect them want them to do, and what should be pretty relatively simple.
Do you think there should be cuts? If not 10%, but strong cuts in the federal spending over the next few years?
I mean, I don't know exactly. I'm not a budget expert, but I don't see how you do this without some cuts. So, and that's part of the compromise on all sides. I think that's part of how this will get done. I want to circle back around and just say one victory also in this was the extension of unemployment insurance. You know, Republicans aren't talking about that necessarily. Not that many people have been, but for a lot of people, that was a huge, huge help.
Well, and the trade-off was you'll all be paying more payroll tax and you'll have less take-home pay starting soon.
That's why I'm quitting my job. I don't want any money.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's the solution.
I think one of the, you know, you can see the maneuvering that's going on for the presidential campaign, well, for the congressional campaign in 2014 and the presidential campaign after that, because the Republicans, one of the reasons Grover Norquist is smiling is because technically we went over the cliff. And so they can say we didn't vote to raise taxes. We voted for tax relief. And that's the, I mean, he tried that with Andrea Mitchell on NBC, and she said, you're living in Alice in Wonderland if you think that. But that is the sort of covering that the Republicans are giving themselves to be. And of course, the Democrats are happy because next election they can say, hey, the Republicans raised taxes. So now that we all agree, we're just negotiating over tax rates. On the other side, the Republicans want the Democrats to take responsibility for cutting Social Security or cutting Medicare and those kinds of things. And so the Democrats are going to have to maneuver into a position where some of those cuts are going to be made, but they can blame it on the Republicans. And so that's part of the sort of dysfunction is the jockeying to set themselves up to be able, because they don't want to have to go into the next election and say, well, we violated all our campaign promises.
Well, and part of the dynamic of our very polarized politics is that the Republican Party is the last thing they want to do is to raise taxes. Democrats, the last thing they want to do is touch Social Security and Medicare. And those are like deeply held religious beliefs for both these parties. And both of those things have to happen. We got some more revenue now. People argue that, you know, we could use, if we really wanted to solve the deficit problem, there we need more tax revenue as well as some pretty substantial cuts. The both things that neither party is motivated to do, and that's why things keep getting kicked down the road. And I guess I wouldn't be entirely surprised if at the end of 2 months there'll be another plan to kick it further down the road.
With nobody would be surprised,
but they'll whittle away at some of their.
Yes, there'll issues. Be some sort of hap. But in terms of if the ultimate task is to deal with a deficit, I think you can probably guarantee that will be kicked down the road in a substantial way.
Yeah,
and in fact, you just heard
just
it.
I kicked my phone account. Down the road.
What happened? That's what they're going to do.
All right. That's good for multitasking.
I was trying to put it in my pocket and missed my pocket.
Let's take a break. And if you have any thoughts about Medicare, I just have some questions. But we'll take a break and ask some more of you all on Weekday.
-46 degrees in Seattle, and that is basically today's predicted high. We're not expected to get out of the mid-40s. Clouds all day, scattered showers this morning, clearing up by afternoon.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hedwig and the Angry Inch, a co-production with Balogun Theater starring Jarek Hoffer, live at the Moore Theater January 15th through the 27th. Tickets available now at stgpresents.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1023, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Bruce Ramsey, Eli Sanders, David Horsey, Knut Berger here reviewing the news of the week with us. Just some thoughts on Medicare, because that, you know, we talk about Social Security, but they put the payroll, they got rid of the payroll tax holiday. Social Security has a slightly better outlook. They were to, without having to change the retirement formula, they could just change, for example, raise the cap on taxes and the like to make it more solvent. But Medicare's in a lot of trouble if they don't change it. And they could, here's just a little statistic here. They could change it to, they could change the Medicare tax, which is at 2.9% now. They could put it up to 4.25%. They could do that. You could just pay more in Medicare taxes.
Ouch.
Would you be willing to do that?
I'm not very happy about that.
What if they made it? What if they made Medicare, as we were saying, you don't have to means test it in the sense of, well, if you're rich, you don't get it. But you could say make it even more of a progressive tax, and as you make more money, even more of your income goes to pay for Medicare, which they have
already in place. I would rather means test it. I mean, this is a government program for providing medical care for people who are old and
poor.
Well, Medicare is
yes.
Yeah, Medicaid is the.
But if you want to means test it, you're going to.
Yeah, I mean, Medicaid is already means tested. That's what it is. But Medicare isn't. And so why should the federal government pay for the medical care of, you know, Bill Gates when he retires or, you know, the CEOs?
Because we're all in this together. That's the argument.
Well, it's kind of a weak argument when it comes to them, and they need the money, and the system is coming up short. And so means testing is one of those things. The problem with raising the tax is that, you know, we've already have all these other taxes, and if I have to pay another 2 cents out of every dollar I earn, you know, that's 2 cents that I don't have, and that with the size of raises that we've been getting recently, that's kind of a big ouch.
What do you think, Eli? Would you either? I mean, the thing about means testing is it changes the nature of the program.
You know, I have to say I haven't paid enough attention to this.
But you've paid enough into it.
Although less than some. I mean, I guess I'm a little less far along and a little further from looking at Medicaid and Medicare personally. And so I just haven't paid as close enough attention to it as I should.
Do you think that the people who are close to getting it now or getting it now should be paying more for their Social Security and Medicare?
People that are close to it.
I asked it expressly.
Like, wait, are you talking about me?
Yes, like us, Dave.
Well, I mean, the question that does seem to be sort of changing the game at the last minute. Although, the thing is,
it's not unprecedented to change the game, right, the rules of the government.
And the reality is, right now, really, this whole battle on all of the whole budget battle and this whole debate really is centered around all these things that we like to do for ourselves but aren't real anxious to pay for. And it may be that we have to do some things that are uncomfortable like that, like changing the rules at the last minute. In a perfect world, yes, Medicare should be for everybody and everyone treated equally. But if the system is falling apart, if we can't pay for it, then you step down and say, okay, apart from the perfect world, how about making people who have the money who can handle this essentially bring in means testing or delay implementation? There are things that simply have to be done. Otherwise, the system is going to go broke.
Well, so what do you think of the argument, Knut, that says when you do that, it loses support, and over time, the erosion in political support for those programs would mean they'd be easier to get rid of?
Well, the consequences of supporting something that's unsustainable has to be taken into account, too. And I think I have the feeling, I mean, people don't want their Social Security cut. They don't want Medicare to disappear when they get to the age where they feel they've qualified for it. The system is so big that you can actually accomplish quite a bit by nibbling at the edges of some of the things, whether it's means testing or raising the retirement age or whatever. And I think part of the strategy for doing that is giving people like Eli some warning that the rules of the game are changing, as opposed to the people that are right at the finish line. And so there is some kind of, you know, generational imbalance there. But, you know, it's complicated. I don't have the answer, but
you don't?
I don't. But except it seems to me you're going to have to do a lot of different tweaks. And the idea that it is just going to be maintained is absolutely sacrosanct. I just don't think in the long term that is going to happen.
You know, one other question about Eli. You mentioned earlier that President Obama getting people leverage coming from popular support and political support. Do you think that happened this time?
A bit. I mean, he did go out into the country and try to rally support and sell the plan, but there was a lot that was going on. I mean, the holiday was coming up. People kind of check out at the end of the year anyway. Newtown, that occupied a lot of his time and attention. So I think he clearly did try to not repeat the mistake of the whole fiscal cliff debacle, and I think it was 2011. Or I'm sorry, not fiscal cliff.
Debt.
Debt ceiling. I'm getting our
your crises,
your debacles,
our cliffs and ceilings mixed up. We went through the ceiling and fell off the cliff. Is that how it happened? So anyway, trying not to repeat that, where he was really criticized for not giving himself enough leverage by rallying popular support. He tried, and you know, I think he did what he could in that respect. I also think there's an argument, and this may be partly behind some of his compromises that the left is upset about. There's an argument for being able to get some other stuff done. So, like, move on with whatever he can move on with in relation to the fiscal cliff, and maybe we can talk about gun control in January, which is what he promised to do anyway.
Or get more jobs into the economy,
which
policies.
Happened today, I believe. We had a new jobs report out that said the economy – I got an email about that.
It was okay.
It's okay?
Yeah. Not great.
The unemployment rate is probably not changed.
Yeah, unchanged. And what was it?
There were
155,000.
They need 200,000 in order to get us. But back to on track where we were before the fall. But I remember when the fall happened in 2009, people said it's going to take 5 or 6 years to come back. And that's still what they're saying, mm-hmm. about 5 or 6 years from when it happened. No Norm Dix in Congress anymore. You going to miss him, Bruce Ramsey?
Not particularly. I mean, I tend to think of a lot of our politicians in Congress as people there to get federal money. It's like, I mean, I grew up in this state. We had Magnuson and Jackson, and they were both like drinking fountains, you know, for local politicians and projects. And hey, that's great if there's lots of money, but it's not what we need for the future. I really, you know, I don't want to keep hearing from my senator and representative on what grants they got. I want them to get the federal government under control. So I don't miss Dix.
On that note, just a side note, so should we be getting a tax write-off for paying sales tax because other people get a tax exemption for paying income tax?
Well, out of fairness, yeah.
Fairness.
I would, you know, I'd be more radical. I'd get rid of Schedule A and get rid of itemized deductions myself. But
You may get that vote.
Yeah, but you know, if the people in Oregon get to write off their income tax, then we ought to get to write off our sales tax.
You going to miss Norm Dix as a congressman?
Well, yeah, of course. Bruce is exactly right. I mean, he was out of the Scoop and Maggie era. He was that style of politician. You take earmarks away from a guy like that, and you know, it's taken all the fun out of it. If you look at what Washington State is today in terms of the amount of benefit that we've received from federal projects, mainly defense and aerospace projects, Norm Dix has been a lion on behalf of Boeing, Fort Lewis, Bremerton, you know, these kinds of things. So he will be missed. He's also, I think, going to be missed for his personal style. I mean, he could work on both sides of the aisle. You know, he's a former Husky football player, had a voice you could hear blocks away. I remember in 2004 going to a John Kerry rally in Tacoma, and the sound system had gone down, and you could still hear Norm Dix at the microphone, you know, three blocks away without being mic'd. You know, he's just a big personality and someone who I think has done a lot to make Washington as great as it is.
Yeah. Well, I walked through the medical building the other day in the Warren G. Magnuson Medical School at the University of Washington. I mean, a lot of the University of Washington's the way it is because of federal money, right?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Absolutely. I beg to differ with Bruce, although, I mean, I dislike wasteful overspending as much as anyone. But
now when it comes to our state,
some money is going to be spent. And I'd like to have somebody there saying, you know, if you're going to spend that, if you're going to have this project, which is worthy, why not do it in our state rather than Arkansas?
That was the old Warren G. Magnuson line, which is, you know.
And it's very true that
they're going to spend it. Why not spend it here?
The University of Washington, for instance, is a great university, not because the legislature ever decided, let's build a great university. It's because Warren Magnuson essentially directed so much federal money at the university, it just got good. There was never a decision by the less stellar politicians in Olympia to make it a great university.
And it's not like we're overfunding education in the state right now or overfunding our, you know, roads and bridges. Well, roads perhaps, but infrastructure maintenance and so on. So there is a need for federal money in the state. And if it's going to be out there, like Horsey says, I mean, maybe we need to shrink the pie to make the federal budget sustainable. But if it's out there, we want our people in Congress fighting for it for us.
Did you just become a Republican?
No, I just became a
pragmatic.
I just continued to be a tax and spend liberal.
Well, you wanted to shrink the pie.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, also, I think we should balance the budget if we can. I mean, I think there's the government is supposed to collect taxes and spend money for the benefit of the people, right? I mean, that's and you caricature that and you call someone a tax and spend liberal, but they are also supposed to keep their budget in balance, in my opinion, if they can. So if it's gotten out of whack as it has, obviously we need to make some compromises, rein in some spending. You can't do this without reining in some spending. And go forward.
I want now the four of you to tell me what the Republican Party should do in the future here.
it's like, oh, I'm sure they're just dying for our advice. They'll listen to Bruce, maybe.
They're not the lights.
Yeah, how many of us are Republicans here?
David Dreyer, House Rules Committee, gave a farewell speech. He said climate change was a top problem in the country. The Washington State Republicans are looking at the demographics, and they're trying to get a sense of where they should align their interests. Where should the Washington State Republicans align their interests? Bruce Ramsey, I'll let you answer that
question. Okay, all right. I'm nominally the Republican here. Well, I think in this state that the Republican Party should take its sort of ideology and tone from the King County suburbs and from Pierce and Snohomish County, that they shouldn't let the religious right call the shots. They should become essentially more libertarian on social issues and let those go. Gay marriage that's done, and just accept it. It's over, and not pick any more fights like that. And comment and focus on fiscal sustainability and smallest government that can actually work and get the job done.
So who is that? Who represents it? Does Rob McKenna represent that?
Rob McKenna's wife represents that.
Yeah, I thought he represented it fairly well. Yeah, he lost, but there are other Republicans in the Senate, got elected that represent that.
Are you running Mrs. McKenna for office?
Well, you asked who the Republican Party in the state should take their marching orders from. Rob McKenna's wife. She's correct in what she's been saying since the election about Republicans needing to get the hell out of people's bedrooms. I think that's how she put it on her Twitter feed, I believe. And she seems to be, McKenna talks about how the party needs to move here and there, but he's still officially where the party is. She's in a different spot. They could be playing the typical game that we've seen very, very often where the wife of a conservative politician comes out and says, well, I'm a little more liberal than my husband, which lets the public think that maybe in private her husband is also a little more liberal than he is in public. Who knows? But where she is where he needs to get to and where the rest of the Republican Party needs to get to. The social issues that they've been flogging in this state are dead and have been dying for a long time. So if they've got a fiscally conservative answer to our state's budget problems, then people will be interested in that. But I don't think anyone wants to hear them talking or acting as mouthpieces for the shrinking religious right in this state anymore.
Well, I agree with that. Yeah.
The fact is, once upon a time, arguably the Republican Party in this state was the more enlightened party. I mean, in the days of Joel Pritchard and Dan Evans and John Miller and various suburban Republicans that I can think of, down in Olympia, they were battling with sort of these old line Democrats who were still stuck in the 30s. And the people with new ideas were those Republicans. They were actually from Seattle, but they're all gone. What they were was a smart pro-business party that had innovative ways to get things done, and that was their focus, to get things done. It was a practical party. The question is, could they possibly even get near that as long as they are now stuck with a major share of their base in sort of the more extreme right, whether you want to, whether they're Tea Partiers or religious right people. I don't know if Republicans can break free of that, partly because I don't know if the talent pool is there anymore. I don't know where the next Joel Pritchard or John Miller would come from.
I just want to say that the coalition that's developing in the state Senate is being designed to showcase exactly the kind of suburban Republicans and suburban Democrats that Bruce was referring to, you know, like Steve Litzau from Mercer Island and Andy Hill and others who are being put on committees dealing with issues like education specifically to, quote, get things done. And it would have happened at a different level had Rob McKenna won. But these are the kind of McKenna Republicans, in some cases maybe even more progressive than McKenna, who are now going to be in charge of solving huge budget problems at the state level.
Well, let me come back to that. We'll take a break. This is Weekday.
-46 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Pretty much what you see is what you get. Expecting to be cloudy for the rest of the day with temperatures right in the mid-40s. And through the weekend, clouds, chance of rain, daytime temps in the mid-40s, overnight temperatures down to the mid-30s.
With a 3D printer, you could make almost anything.
So here we have a shoe.
Rings, bracelets, yeah. Pendants, iPhone cases.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Is it a cool new toy or the next industrial revolution?
Why do we not make 100,000 but only a few products and then scale as we need it?
That story today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 7 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Hillside Student Community School, dedicated to cultivating critical thinking, creativity, and the courage to take risks. Grades 5 through 12, college prep, small classes, in Bellevue since 1969. Open house Saturday, January 12th. More at hillsidesc.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:41. Former Congresswoman and shooting victim Gabrielle Giffords is planning a visit to Newtown, Connecticut, the site of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. More about that in our 11 o'clock newscast. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
We are reviewing the news of the week on Weekday with Knute Berger, David Horsey, Eli Sanders, Bruce Ramsey. Knute, you mentioned the question of how the Senate was taking, the state Senate was taking shape in terms of leadership, how they were going to tackle it. And I was just, to get there, I just have a, I'm going to take a little step back, a broader question. Does the Republican Party's commitment to fully funding education give them a way to, if they follow through, Bruce Ramsey, I'll start with you, if give them a way to prove their point?
Prove their point about what?
Well, that they can be a moderate, pragmatic people who get things
done.
Well,
it depends on how they do it. It depends on how they do it. Yeah, it's a step in that direction. And then you get in this whole issue of, you know, are you going to do it through the tax swap with local property taxes subtracted and then the statewide, basically an increase in the state property tax. McKenna seemed to favor that. Governor-elect Inslee said he didn't, which is maybe a problem. Or are they going to do the Gregoire approach of let's put it on the gas tax and fund all the school buses off of a sales tax on fuels?
Of course, they have to do a lot of things in order to get to the amount of money they're saying they need over the next 6 to 8 years.
Well, the amount of money, they keep using the figure of $1 billion, and that's not, you know, in the court decision, but still they have to satisfy the court.
Yeah, well, I saw that Joint Task Force on Education Funding, those folks came out with their numbers, and by 2018 they were up to $4 billion in additional funding.
Well, that's going to be difficult.
Speaking of the court, I'm going to repeat what I said last week in the hopes that someone on the state Supreme Court listens to the Weekday.
gets it going?
The biggest thing that will determine, I think, from my point of view, how all of this is handled in the legislative session is whether the Supreme Court finally comes forward with its decision on the two-thirds majority requirement. We're about to start the legislative session. They've been considering this since the fall of last year. They signaled that they were going to expedite this in a way, deliver a speedy decision so that their decision on whether Iman's two-thirds majority is in fact constitutional or not could be made useful, you know, or made use of in the legislative session. and another week has come and gone without a decision from the high court. Their ruling on this will determine both how the Republican Party and the Democratic Party in Olympia can envision dealing with the budget. Now, obviously, you need both of them coming together to raise taxes for the most part. But without the two-thirds majority in place, it makes it a lot easier to get there and then to plug revenue into the equation for dealing with our shortfall in education funding and all kinds of other fundings rather than just cuts.
What do you think of what Jay Inslee has done in terms of the people he's put in place, Eli? Do any of those people reflect, you know, that notion you're talking about of trying to get just a simple majority? More arm twisters? Did you see any more arm twisters in who
you know? I've just started looking at the team that they're talking about. I know they sent out an email yesterday listing some of them. The name I, of course, recognized was David Postman, who's
communications director,
right? Who's actually traveled a really interesting path to come back to Olympia, where he was the chief political reporter for the Seattle Times and covered the Capitol as well as a lot of other levels of politics. But I think he will be a big asset to the Inslee team. He knows basically everyone who works in journalism in the state, and he knows how the Capitol works. So there's one player who seems to be a very good hire for Inslee.
Any other players for any of you folks that think they seem interesting or we see something happening, or is it all pretty quiet?
I don't follow Olympia very closely, but
you are missing out.
I know. What can I say? They don't care about it in Los Angeles. But I think the one seemingly smart thing that Inslee is doing is saying, okay, everybody has to reapply for their job. You know, he seems to be shaking it up, and I think whether you love Democrats or not, when one party has been in control of the governor's mansion for so many years and in charge of the state bureaucracy, it always needs some shaking up. So to bring in some new people with some new ideas, especially ideas about how you can keep state services going in very lean times, it seems like a smart way to go.
Yeah, it was reported this week that Inslee's hired a executive search firm or headhunting firm to help him find talent. You know, he's going to have a blend of people who really know Olympia. Dave Postman's a great example of somebody who really has covered politics down there a long time. He's also been on the corporate side at Vulcan. So he has both an insider and outsider perspective. So, you know, he's going to have a combination of people who really know how Olympia works, which means experienced people. And of course, with the Democrats having been in for a while, there's been some continuity. People who've been there, you know, since the Lowry or Locke years or whatever, who really know what they're doing and who have been able to manage in a very difficult budget times. And then he's got to bring in some fresh ideas, and because obviously there's a lot of stuff down there that just a budget necessity is going to have to be rethought. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, how well some of these changes are implemented. You know, things like you know, reducing the number of DMV offices and getting more people to do things online. You know, well, that can work great or it can not work great depending on how it's implemented, depending on what kinds of technologies you use. I think Inslee is very interested in having people that come down to Olympia who really know how to do that stuff better than it has been done in the past.
I'm waiting to see who he appoints for OFM, Office of Financial Management. You know, Governor Gregoire had Marty Brown, and a smart guy, knew the numbers, but Inslee needs to have somebody who knows that, but also who's not afraid to talk back to his boss and say, hey, you know, what you're suggesting is impossible. We need to do this or whatever. That's going to be important.
And a very big early test of Inslee and his new team is going to be the budget that he puts forward. Gregoire already put forward her budget, and Inslee came out the same day, I mean, I think within an hour of Gregoire's budget coming out, and said, well, that's nice. I'm paraphrasing it here, but essentially said, you know, thanks, but I'm going to put forward my own budget, and it's going to be different, was the implication. So everyone will be watching very closely to see what ideas Inslee has that are different than Gregoire's, who, you know, after 8 years in the governor's mansion said you cannot solve this problem without raising revenue. I've tried every other way possible, and you can't do it. But Inslee, who promised not to raise taxes, is going to have to figure out a way to do it if he's going to stick with his campaign promise, which maybe he should modify.
Well, he made that promise, and also the voters of the state passed Mr. Eyman's two-thirds measure yet again with 64% of the vote. So that's a pretty strong voice.
The stranger's advice to Jay on this, and we've put it in the paper already. Maybe
mostly
maybe
also twice. The Supreme Court justices as well, listening to the same advice.
Right. Please go ahead. I mean,
and the Seattle Times advice to him is don't raise tax.
Yeah, well, the
like
stranger
that.
Advice to him is don't be another Chris Gregoire. She didn't just, well, it's hard to believe that she just had a revelation in her eighth year as governor that you can't solve this problem without raising revenue. It was probably pretty clear to her sometime before the eighth year. And for political reasons, my guess would be she didn't do it. And now Inslee has boxed himself into the same conundrum. And either you sit inside that box for 8 years if he gets reelected and let the people of Washington suffer, or you just kick that box over at the start and let, you know, the political chips fall where they may, but say, I'm sorry, I actually have looked at this more closely now, and I'm going to listen to our last governor, and I'm going to say, you know what, we don't need to raise revenue a lot, but we do need to have revenue in the equation.
And I see you want to argue for
oh,
no tax.
Well, actually, we're not making a solid no tax pledge. I think, you know, we would probably support the levy swap idea if it's done well.
I have another question on that note. So Governor Gregoire's goal, budget, had a goal in it of not raising college tuition this time over the next 2 years. And many of the university presidents thought that was a bad idea. They still need to raise tuition again because they are not getting the money from the legislature. So I guess the way that plays out will tell us something about how things are going. What do you think about the governor's goal?
Well, I think more revenues are needed. So you've got to find those some way. And I think it's both a short and a long term issue that you need to deal with. I think you brought up a great example of the push pull, which is okay. You can't have everything you want. You can't have world class universities and that can provide a very low cost higher education to as many people as possible, and not have the revenues to do that. And so if the only choice you have is raising the tuition, you're going to undercut that goal in order to keep the world class part, but you're not going to serve the group. So, you know, it will be interesting to see how those tensions are resolved. I'd just like to say a couple things about the revenue situation. One is that, remember, even with the Eyman thing, if you can get two-thirds of the legislature to agree on a plan, and I think that ought to be the kind of goal that you look at when you're crafting something as broadly popular as education. Even I think the intent of the Senate is to go in and not raise taxes. But if you looked at some kind of revenue stream, dedicated revenue stream, or a new revenue stream of fees or taxes that would fund something like that and put that to a vote, you might be able to get it passed if it's an innovative, interesting, and good plan. So I think the idea of just saying, oh, the revenues are impossible, I think is a real it's a real mistake. The other thing is I think Inslee should begin to formulate and sell a complete tax system revamp in Washington State. In other words, get us toward a fairer, more progressive tax system overall. And it may not be something he could accomplish in 4 years or 8 years, but begin to make the case for that, which I felt Gregoire could have done and really did not.
So you're not talking necessarily income tax. You're talking the question of tax breaks, tax progressivity.
Tax loopholes.
That's, yeah, exactly. And the B&O tax reform. I think one of the suspicions Washingtonians kind of rightly have about the tax system is that there's a lot unfair about it and a lot regressive about it. If you could come up with a comprehensive system that address those issues, you might actually, just as they're trying to do in Washington, D.C., you might actually come up with a system that's more fair and generates as much or more revenue than the current system.
Just as you're listening to what Knut's saying, you begin to realize even further how much the Supreme Court has already constrained what the legislature must do regarding the budget. The Supreme Court is forcing the legislature to fully fund education in the state and make everything else kind of revolve around that as they should. And so this is another way to look at the kind of absurdity of the court demanding that the legislature fund X to X level, but then leaving everyone hanging in limbo as to what the vote requirement is for getting funding for things like education at X level.
Eli, we're taking you down. We're going to Olympia. And we're marching on those guys. He wants to ask
down there.
March on the court.
The justices. I don't think are moved by that. But maybe they listen to radio.
Yeah, let's hope so. Let's hope they are. On that sort of broader question of the idea for how to do things, I was just curious. I'm going to go very big and then very small. Because, you know, LA Times, you have to think about big issues.
Big,
huge. What's rankling Los Angeles editors?
Oh, wow. Now,
I don't mean Los Angeles things, but is it all Washington, D.C., fiscal cliff? Is that their concerns, or are you hearing from other things?
Well, there's Lindsay Lohan as well. LA has particular concerns.
It's all celebrity news.
But, yeah, yeah, the fiscal cliff is consumed. I suppose the other big issue that's on people's minds is what's going to happen in terms of guns and the broader issue of all the issues that have been brought about by Newtown and in terms of not only restricting guns but also changing the way we deal with mental illness and. And then the sort of more amorphous issues about the culture, you know.
So they're keeping that top of mind. That's top of mind for them still.
Yeah, I'll speak for them. Sure.
Yeah, I think you should. Why not?
No, I think definitely. That's part of the big national discussion and certainly part of what has been appearing in the LA Times.
So Eli, I was just wondering, so beyond guns. Have you been looking at what people are most concerned about as our mayoral race is taking shape? Do some of these fiscal issues filter down to some of these candidates, or are they on a different track?
To the Seattle mayoral race?
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yes, Seattle mayoral race.
In a way, if I was going to connect the mayoral race to fiscal issues, I mean, one thing that we just put out, you know, our kind of marching orders to the mayoral candidates, the Stranger Election Control Board said, here's what we want to hear you guys saying, and laid down our markers for this race. And one was connected to the Bicycle Master Plan and said we want it fully funded, and one way to do that is to get federal funding and to be more aggressive about that. So there's one connection. If there's less federal funding for things like bike improvements, that affects, you know, the mayor's ability to do that. Same with transportation issues, you know, funding for an extension of light rail to Ballard, for example, or any of the other big transportation projects that we might want the mayor to champion would probably, in a best-case scenario, involve some federal funding. So if you're looking for me to make that connection, I think that's
pretty
where
good.
It gets made.
All right. Now we'll get your marching orders another time.
Well, why should the federal government pay for bicycles in Seattle?
Well, that you get to end on that note. Bruce Ramsey ends on that note. He is editorial writer at the Seattle Times. Eli Sanders is associate editor. The Stranger, David Horsey, is political cartoonist and columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Knut Berger writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com. And Bernard Ouellette is now our engineer and midday announcer. And Bernard, you got to sleep in, right?
Yes, very nice, Steve.
6
very
o'clock.
Nice. Huh?
Just like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it seemed almost decadent, really.
Yeah.
Hours later than I used to sleep. Pretty sweet.
And now you'll just have to stay late.
I'm happy with that.
All right. Well,
it's good to be here.
Good to have you here. Andy Hirsch is no longer our engineer. Bernard Ouellette is. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell. But Andy, we will keep you working. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amin Al-Sadeh. I'm Steve Scherer. We'll talk to you on Monday. Have a good weekend. You guys have a good weekend.
You too,
Steve. You too.
It's 10:59. I am Bernard Ouellette. Idaho Republican Senator Michael Crapo pleads guilty to driving while intoxicated, seeks forgiveness and repentance. More about that in the news just ahead. 47 degrees in Seattle. Forecast calls for clouds for the rest of today and through the weekend. Chance of rain, daytime temperatures in the mid-40s.
Guns are one of the most durable of durable goods, and that's a challenge for gun manufacturers.
You have sort of a practical problem in the gun industry of producing a product that has a long shelf life.
I'm Sarah Gardner, the gun industry's durability problem. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6:30, KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Custom Pure, the water store, providing water filters for the kitchen and bath with home and office installation and service since 1981, located in Shoreline and online at CustomPure.com.
Later today, life lessons from a fictional movie character. Jen Kugler works at Scarecrow Video here in Seattle, and she's seen a lot of... Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.